Hey there, thanks for watching The Damage Report. I am not John Iadarola. No, I'm not. I'm Brooke Thomas, and I'm sitting next to Brett Ehrlich, and we are hanging out for John.
I am John Iadarola. Now that's the mystery. Here's the stuff. John could be here right now. For those of you listening at home, John and Cenk are going to be in Detroit live for our debate coverage, which you should tune in for this Tuesday and Wednesday. Right after the debates are done, you guys need to come and watch TYT live, tyt.com/live, and you'll be able to see our immediate aftermath coverage of the debates. John and Cenk are both doing that tomorrow. John, when he travels, just loses it. He's the kind of person who goes, oh, did I need to bring my driver's license to the airport? Why? The pilot's driving. He's that kind of person. He said to me, I can't hang out yesterday. I mean, he was going to hang out. I can't hang out yesterday because I have to pack.
He couldn't hang out at 1
p.m.
That's
not an excuse. Packing is taking stuff from a drawer and putting it in a suitcase. People say they have to pack. That just means I'm a nervous flyer.
Yeah, that's true, because I pack in the hour before it's time for my flight. And I do like to get to the airport on like at least an hour early. I like to get there an hour early, but I also pack an hour before I leave.
But if you said an hour early to someone, they would be like, oh, that's so cutting it close.
Right.
That's what's frustrating. When people say they need to pack, they're like, oh my, I have to do this crazy math. I have to count how many days I'll be gone and bring that much underwear.
He's like, I need swimsuits, I need socks, I need sneakers to work out in.
So he'll be
cool
gone.
Sneakers to wear to the, to.
Yeah, he's going to some crazy, we won't talk about it till he gets back and has the opportunity to defend himself, but he's not just going to Detroit. He's got another trip. But we have an amazing show, don't we?
We do. We have an interesting show. We're talking about Donald Trump and his racism. We're talking about Kamala Harris and a couple confusing plans, but they're plans. We're going to break them down. And we had a bit of a debate, one of many.
Yeah.
We had a bit of a debate. One of many unsettled debates between Brooke and Brett
that
you are not privy to.
I was told when we're on the air, don't talk to me like that.
Yes, I had to be. I did. I had to be like, okay. Okay.
So stay tuned for the last.
Because he's going to do it anyway, and it's totally going to be fine. So, all right, let's get started.
This is what a morning show feels like.
Yeah, that's what this is. Yeah. That's why I like doing it with you. I'm sorry it makes you work so much.
I'm excited for this first soul-crushing story.
Yeah, it is, because the president of the United States, Donald Trump, spent the weekend attacking black men on Twitter. And to be fair, it wasn't just that, because he did attack Nancy Pelosi. He attacked, not attacked, but he retweeted and basically like gave credence to, agreed with Jeanine Pirro in this weird deep state conspiracy theory that was blown away she actually does on live television.
She sounds like a really awesome person.
Who should have never been a judge. But so let's get back to what happened Saturday morning. When Trump woke up early in the morning, I think it was 7 in DC, and decided it was high time to attack Congressman, longtime Congressman and House Oversight Committee Chairman Elijah Cummings. He tweeted this. Rep Elijah Cummings has been a brutal bully, shouting and screaming at the great men and women of Border Patrol about conditions at the southern border when actually, his Baltimore district is far worse and more dangerous. His district is considered the worst in the USA. He also said, as proven last week during a congressional tour, the border is clean, efficient, and well-run, just very crowded. He misspelled Cummings' name here. It says Cummings District is a disgusting rat and rodent infested mess. If he spent more time in Baltimore, maybe he could help clean up this very dangerous and filthy place. And then once more, saying, why is so much money sent to the Elijah Cummings district when it is considered the worst run and most dangerous anywhere in the United States? No human being would want to live there. Where is all this money going? How much is stolen? Investigate this corrupt mess immediately. So many things to touch on there. One could say that it's a congressman's responsibility. If we're even just going to agree with anything that he says, it would be. But wouldn't it also be the president of the United States? And that just seems a little off.
So back when Obama was the president, Trump blamed Obama for Baltimore being poor, specifically. So when they say there's always a tweet, there is absolutely a tweet when he says, Baltimore is falling apart. Why isn't Obama doing something? So that's one thing where, well, by his own logic, he set forth, he should be holding himself responsible. Not only that, but literally the head of housing and urban development under Donald Trump is Ben Carson. And Ben Carson was the lead surgeon at Johns Hopkins. Johns Hopkins is where? Baltimore. So the head of housing and urban development that you chose, probably because you were just like, he's black. He's from Baltimore. So you, Ben Carson, and Elijah Cummings could all sit down and have a conversation about how to fix this stuff. And guess what? That's what Cummings does every day, fighting for ways to fix his district and the country.
Also, do you know who else could join in that meeting? Jared Kushner.
Yeah, so good.
Who's
this is my favorite the family? Part of it.
They own what a lot of the residents in Baltimore call slums. They call him a slumlord.
Yes.
He owns what people consider projects.
Yes, that is their business. That is the Kushner bread and butter. Yeah, it's bread and butter. Their bread and butter is creating terrible housing conditions for people who can't even afford bread or butter.
Right. In rat infested, what type of human being would want to live there? These things. This is horrible, and it is racist, and I don't even think that like one should have to break down why it is, because I don't believe that people who ask that question are being genuine.
Right, I'm with you on that. Yeah. It's the same as send them back. It's
right.
Like close your eyes and think about this person.
Mm-hmm.
Who use your emotional intelligence to, and then close your eyes and feel it. Now look me in the eye and say the person who says this stuff isn't terribly racist.
Right.
And that's what's so frustrating about Trump, is Trump has essentially gone through, and at the same time that he's tweeting, oh, no one's done more for African American employment than me.
Which
and
is also so misleading and frustrating.
Utterly misleading and utterly frustrating. He then goes and says, no one's done any more for them than I have, you know, when I'm not calling them animals and saying the places they live are crap.
And infested. And so, you know, this is, and I think about this all the time. I knew this was going to be bad under him. I did not know it was going to be this bad. I did not know that we were going to wake up every single day to racist tweets from the person who's supposed to be the leader of all of us, all of our country. And this hit especially close to home for CNN's Victor Blackwell. And I think that you don't often see news anchors break down like this on television. And I think it just goes to the weight of what the president is doing. So I want to show you this. Take a look.
There are challenges, no doubt, but people are proud of their community. I don't want to sound self-righteous, but people get up and go to work there. They care for their families there. They love their children who pledge allegiance to the flag, just like people who live in districts of congressmen who support you, sir. They are Americans too.
That's who would want to live there. People, bunch of black people who are happy to live there. Of course, they want better lives. Of course, they want better opportunity and cleaner streets and neighborhoods, but they want to live in Baltimore.
And then, yes, and reasonable people would look and say, listen, there's communities that face challenges and they want to overcome those challenges.
Yeah.
Of course, they do. But at the same time, you have Trump's yes men, like Mick Mulvaney went after Congressman Cummings, saying that I can't believe that he would have such poverty in his district. Mick Mulvaney's district has a higher poverty rate than Baltimore. And people who are pointing out to everyone who's tweeting up against Cummings, here's poverty around the country. And while it does say it is kind of a whataboutism, what it should do, if Trump is this grand distractor, I'll take that conversation. I will let him distract me to a discussion of poverty in America Monday through Monday, 7 days a week, because of this reason. What Donald Trump has done as president has cut taxes for the wealthy and made life better for rich people. But he's made life worse for poor people. And those poor people you see are living in cities.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see the tweets that everyone's hurling at Congressman Cummings. And they live in rural areas, as you'll see in all of the, well, what about in your backyard tweets that you're seeing right now. And if this next election is based on whether people in those districts all around the country are facing adverse circumstances in the face of a president who says that he's fixed every problem in America, I'll have that conversation every day of the week.
So before we go, there's so much, because he continued to tweet about Congressman Cummings all weekend long. And he also woke up this morning tweeting about Reverend Al Sharpton, which was fascinating and racist. But I think there's a lot of talk about like the media getting it wrong and not being willing to call things out and call them what they are. But sometimes the media gets it right. And I do want to point out an editorial in the Baltimore Sun. They published this, I thought, powerful editorial titled, "Better to have a few rats than to be one." And I want to read you just part of it. Just towards the end, they say, you know, finally, while we would not sink to name calling in the Trumpian manner or ruefully pointing out that he failed to spell the congressman's name correctly, we would tell the most dishonest man to ever occupy the Oval Office, the mocker of war heroes, the gleeful grabber of women's private parts, the serial bankrupter of businesses, the useful idiot of Vladimir Putin, and the guy who insisted there are good people among murderous neo-Nazis, that he's still not fooling most Americans into believing he's even slightly competent in his current post, or that he, oh my goodness.
He possesses a scintilla of integrity.
Thank you. Better to have some vermin living in your neighborhood than to be one.
Yep. So we are going to call him names, but guess what? He deserves it.
Right. We're not going to call him names, but we are. And we are. That's what happened.
Yep. Don't go away. We come back. We got Parker Malloy. She's going to talk about the systematic way in which the people on the right really don't care about facts as long as they can get some cool burn to pass around. Don't go away. We need to talk about a relatively new show called Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time. So the Green New Deal's only objective is to eliminate cows and build railways to Europe. That's something I heard from someone that I actually think to be a smart person. And that is essentially the messaging apparatus at work of the Republican Party. So how did those kinds of sound bites make their way to your ears? Well, here with us right now is Parker Malloy, the editor-at-large from Media Matters for America. Parker, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So basically you did a piece recently outlining the ways in which the Republican messaging apparatus works, and you say that it is untethered to reality. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Sure. So what happened here was I was watching Hannity, as one does, and you know, just for nice leisure time. And I heard him just last week or the week before say something about Green New Deal. It's going to abolish airplanes and cows and the combustion engine. And I heard all of that and I thought that sounded familiar. And then I went back and did a search to see how he's framed this in the past. And it turns out that he's used almost that exact same framing something like 80 times now. So I put together a little compilation and I decided to write something about this. But basically what'll happen is when the Green New Deal first came out, there was that FAQ document that was put out that made a joke about, you know, how they won't be able to get rid of cows and airplanes that fast within 10 years. And conservatives kind of just ran with it. And that has stuck for months now. That came out in February and it's almost August. So I was trying to figure out why they repeat this debunked talking point, because it was that same day that people said, no, this isn't in the resolution. However, people have kept saying it. And then in doing some research on this, I found that Fox viewers were the most informed or the self-identified as informed on this in this survey that I saw, and also believed all sorts of horrible things about what the Green New Deal was. Now, it should be clear that the Green New Deal, it's a non-binding resolution. If it passed passed Congress right now, and even if, you know, if that happened, it would not really commit the U.S. to doing anything. It would just kind of be a show of good faith. However, the way that you hear this talked about on Fox News is that it's going to destroy the economy, that is going to result in you no longer being able to eat meat or fly planes. You'll have to take a train to Europe. It's all sorts of ridiculous stuff, but it works. This tactic of telling people that all these things that are not in the Green New Deal are in there has been actually very effective. Fox viewers they view the Green New Deal the most negatively of any demographic, even more than Republicans as a whole. And that's kind of startling. It's something like 93% of Fox viewers view the Green New Deal as extremely negative, which was kind of shocking. So what I did in this piece was I went and I looked back at other examples throughout time where this same sort of approach has been used. And, you know, one of the previous examples that I used is the lie about death panels, which obviously was not true, but that was repeated nonstop on Fox.
People are still saying that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. The law has been in effect for something like 8 years, and you still have people who think that the law has death panels. So in their minds, for 8 years, there have been old people like getting put in front of these panels and just sent to death, and everyone else is cool with it. That's something they think is happening, but it's something like 40% or 30% of Americans believe this, which is startling because it was obviously false and it was debunked very, very quickly, but it stuck. And I saw another example of that was looking around that same time at the effort to shut down Acorn. And it was that same sort of tactic where these debunked narratives would get repeated over and over until they just destroyed the whole organization.
Sorry, Parker.
Go ahead.
Oh, so why does this work so well? Why? When the information, sure. the facts are available, why does this work so well?
Well, one of the reasons I think this works as well as it does, and this was supported by some of the evidence that I cite in the piece, is that one thing that right-wing media does is they give more coverage to these issues than mainstream outlets or progressive media. You will see the Green New Deal, something like in the first 4 days, there were 32 or 33 segments on Fox News, whereas there were 11 on CNN and MSNBC combined. So you have the people who are hopefully putting things out there in a factual way on CNN, MSNBC, other mainstream outlets. And then you have Fox, who is almost exclusively putting this out there in terms of propaganda.
So lies,
yeah.
So does it end up? Is there a way to counteract it? Because you do see people like us and people like CNN a lot of the time going out there and saying this is false. And if people are just going back to Fox News, is there a way that you think other politicians can message or media organizations can package facts to kind of break through that bubble?
Sure. I think one of the things that politicians can do quickly in these situations is to not let rumors float out there. I think that the longer that rumors float, the more likely they are to take. And I think that may not have been true 15, 20 years ago, but it certainly is now. Now you can have a rumor on the internet that's there. If it hangs out there for a day or two, you'll have some people turning it all the way into, so I heard that the Green New Deal, something about Comet ping pong, you know, like it's suddenly it just turns into like a giant conspiracy theory if you don't debunk it. So I think that that's important. I think that putting out accurate information and saying this is a lie straight away. And I understand the reluctance to do that because there are certain things that really shouldn't have to be dignified with an answer or a response. and like this. But we live in a world where people are very skeptical of the media as a whole. And I think if something isn't put out there in clear, plain terms, that they're not going to, they're not going to get it. And the Green New Deal was only, it's a 14-page resolution, and yet you see it, you know, people just clearly haven't read it, and it's short.
Yeah, and I highly recommend that everybody goes and reads the Green New Deal in its entirety, and also Parker's piece, Lies, Damn Lies in Media, Right-Wing Repetition of Debunked Narratives Reshapes Reality. So thank you so much, Parker, for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Parker.
Thanks.
All right, don't go away. When we come back, we have a lot of Kamala Harris news. She's got a Medicare for all-ish plan and also a plan for giving Pell Grants. Caveat, caveat, caveat. Don't go away.
Oh my goodness. All right, Senator and 2020 hopeful Kamala Harris released two big plans over the weekend and this morning that are getting a lot of attention. This morning she revealed her Medicare for All plan, and her Medicare for All plan preserves private health insurance, which of course doesn't make sense for me.
It's Kamala Harris's Medicare for That's All plan.
Oh, okay. Is it that bad?
Is that all? You know, I don't want to chime in on whether it's good or bad.
Okay,
yet.
I respect that. Okay.
Yet. We should lay out what it is.
Okay.
First.
All right. So, you know, she started off kind of explaining no panicked parent. This is kind of something that she says on the campaign trail all the time. No panicked parent should hold a sick child while worrying about an expensive hospital bill. No senior should have to cut their pill in half just to make ends meet. And what we found out is under the proposal, Americans could opt for Medicare Advantage, and that's a program that allows beneficiaries to get coverage from a private insurer. Harris's plan, though, would put all Americans into Medicare over a 10-year transition period, but then while allowing the participation of private insurance plans under a different set of rules. She also said her plan would not raise taxes on households making less than $100,000 a year, of course, unlike Sanders' proposal, which she has acknowledged would require middle class tax hikes to eliminate out-of-pocket costs. Harris did not offer a cost estimate, but proposed to help pay for her program with a 0.2% tax on Wall Street stock trades and a 0.1% tax on bond trades and an even smaller tax on derivative transactions. She said she'd also tax offshore corporate income the same way domestic corporate income is taxed. So the biggest issue here, I think, that a lot of people get frustrated by when candidates are even asked, you know, would you do away with private health insurance, is that the way the system works now is that unless everybody has government insurance, there will be bad, you know, medical facilities and good ones. Unless everybody can go anywhere and everybody gets paid the same thing from the same people.
Yeah.
So how would this work? How would this not be a plan where we still have, you know, government-run health clinics, which aren't as good as, you know, going to Kaiser?
Right. So this is an interesting plan.
Okay.
For many reasons. First of all, when she was in the debates, there was this moment where it was like, who would be Medicare for All?
Right.
And your hand goes up.
Right.
I don't know. And then afterwards, it was clarifying. This is the clarity question mark that we have coming out of it. This to me, so Bernie's is a 4-year transition, Kamala's is a 10-year transition. Terms for presidents are 8 years.
Right.
So
that's a good point.
It kind of makes it so, like, you know how these last 2.5 years of Trump's presidency have felt like a millennium? Like, it will take a long time under her plan. But what she wants to do is go up to people and find a way that when she messages, she can say, if you like your insurance provider, you can keep it. And then go to the people who have Medicare and like the Medicare for All system and say, we are going to a Medicare for All system. And unfortunately, I think it's going to come out in the wash for her in terms of messaging. I feel like she's going to run into the problem of people going, what? are you talking about?
Right.
What are you talking about?
I think that's what I don't understand, just, you know, as a person, just why everyone's not on the same page with the messaging, because I have never felt like I love my insurance. When I had like great insurance, it would be the doctor. And if I could go to that same doctor with any type of insurance, I'm cool with that.
Right. So the argument for Medicare for All is, listen, we have a private insurance system that no one else has,
right?
And we're awesome. America's the best. Our movies are fantastic. But like, we pay twice as much for health coverage / services,
right,
and we die sooner.
Right.
So let's look around at people who pay less
and see what they
and
do.
And don't die sooner,
right,
and actually live longer and see what they do. And this doesn't really reflect any of those, but it just allows her to say, I want a Medicare for All based on what Medicare is now. Medicare does have private insurance supplements. I think the disingenuous part of it is, under Bernie Sanders' plan for Medicare, he's not saying we're going to get rid of the health services that you have. Mm-hmm. He's saying we are going to essentially collectivize all of the negotiation and all of the price, the ability for people to negotiate lower prices on health insurance by putting it in the hands of the government, which is what other countries who do it better than us do.
Why isn't the messaging like that, though? Like, you know, you and you, all of you union members who love your doctors, you get to keep your doctors. And you, you'll finally get to go to one.
The specific reason is because Obama said, if you like your doctor, you can keep them. And that didn't pan out.
Okay.
I mean, that's really the specific reason.
That makes sense. All right, so we got to move on to another plan, which this one got more attention. And maybe it's just because the Medicare for All plan is so new. It just was released this morning. But Senator Harris tweeted this. She said, I announced that as president, I'll establish a student loan debt forgiveness program for Pell Grant recipients who start a business that operates for 3 years in disadvantaged communities. So
what, I mean, you love Kamala Harris and you've decided you're going to vote for her.
Whoa, that is so inappropriate.
It's so not true. Basically, you have mentioned things that you like recently.
I do. There are a lot of things that I really like about Senator Harris, yes.
Yeah, and you have not, she has not said that she's voting for anyone.
Right.
She has said that
I will vote. Yeah,
she will vote, all that stuff. But so what do you, when you see that, you see we're gonna forgive your whatever, and caveat. Mm-hmm. What's your reaction to seeing a tweet like that?
So I was like, what? What about, just from seeing the tweet, and I think I had the same reaction that a lot of other people had. What about teachers? What about people in the healthcare industry? What about me? What about other people who don't, I have no desire to start a business. I don't want to start a business. What about all these other people who are working hard, who owe too much in student loans, but don't want to start a business? What about that? What about the fact that businesses usually fail in the first year? Where are you gonna get the money to start a business when you don't have the money to pay off your student loans?
And especially if you don't last 3 years, guess what you have? More debt. So that's gonna be difficult. And you'll get into all the reasons why this is kind of taken out of context, but like, this is something that Trump does well, mm-hmm, and Democrats sometimes do poorly. Trump will just repeat a message over and over. That is simple. And Kamala thinks people can handle nuance, and she'll be like, here's one of the plans that I have that you can forgive student loan debt if you've done these three things. And people really have had a field day with it in terms of, like, I saw a funny t-shirt that someone tweeted, like,
you said that
I sent
me.
It to you. Yeah. It was like, I'm getting my loan debt forgiven if I do this and I do that and I return the ring to Mordor, like that kind of stuff.
So essentially, once I read the plan, I think that this was the wrong tweet to push out with this plan. Mm-hmm. I think this is essentially a grant to encourage more Black Americans to enter the STEM fields, which does include nursing, which was confusing because I think that's maybe not spelled out as best as it could. This is not a student loan forgiveness plan. This is a grant policy that many, many, many people do not qualify for. Mm-hmm. But so just pitching it as that, that's something super cool and something needed and something great. The problem is that it was pitched as a student loan forgiveness policy, and it's up against people saying, hey, we're about to wipe it clean. That's it, because nobody should be in debt like that. And it didn't hold up next to that. It was a bad tweet.
Yeah.
And, period. I think it's a cool plan that I don't qualify for and many other people don't, but it's not a student loan forgiveness plan. everyone should read. I'll just try to run through a couple things. Harris will invest $60 billion in STEM education at HBCUs and other MSIs, which are minority serving institutions. I had never heard that acronym. She'll work with Congress to create a $12 billion capital grant and technical support program, which will go directly to helping minority small business owners start businesses. She'll direct the U.S. Department of Commerce Minority Business Development Agency to distribute these funds, leveraging its nationwide network of business development centers. She'll also tackle the enormous student debt burdens with which so many Black Americans are saddled. And that's when we go into the Pell Grant, up to $23,000 of debt forgiveness there. And her surrogates are saying that her student loan debt forgiveness plan is coming.
I think
this is not it.
And she also wanted to be like, not only am I investing all this money, but some of it will go to forgiving student debt.
Right.
But she just didn't message that very clearly, and people have seized on it.
Yeah.
But all of this is part of an attempt to win South Carolina, period.
Yeah.
Yeah, she has to, because she needs to. I mean, yes, the people who analyze campaigns are pretty simple. And it's like, she is Black. She needs to win the Black vote. And Black people live in South Carolina. So she needs to do things to win that so she can fit the expectations we just made up.
Done. We'll be right back.
Facial recognition is sweeping across the country. Tech companies are building it, law enforcement agencies are using it, and our politicians are doing little to stop it.
Facial recognition, fighting for a free internet, these are one of the many things that I've seen come from Get Your News with Ron. Ron Pacone, welcome to the Damage Report. How you been, man?
I've been good, Brett. How are you? Thanks for having me.
So great to have you on. I know you got a new news show that you started up, and I know that you're working with Fight for the Future. So just kind of give us an update on what you've been up to with that organization.
So yeah, Fight for the Future, we last month in June, so almost 2 months ago, but back in June, we did a big campaign for net neutrality where we showed up in Washington, D.C. We presented Mitch McConnell's office with 3.5 million petitions in favor of net neutrality to try to force the Senate to act on it. Net neutrality has been repealed since 2017. Since then, we've, of course, had court battles going on for it. And now we're working on a campaign to ban facial recognition. And facial recognition, you know, as you played in the video there, it's one of those things where we always face the question of, well, does the benefit outweigh the cost? You know, we always want to have a secure environment for ourselves in a society, but does the cost of whatever we're trying to institute, is it worthwhile? And with facial recognition, the software is poor at best, and that's being generous. There was a study out of England that the facial recognition software that they studied, it got it wrong about 98% of the time, meaning it misidentified people 98% of the time.
That sounds pretty reliable to me. 98, that's an A. That's an A plus, right?
You know, the first thing I thought was I was like, you know, I remember it's been a couple years since I took the SAT, but I'm pretty sure you would get a higher score than that just by putting your name on the piece of paper. I'm pretty sure. So yeah, 2%. What was the score they were going there with? And it also commonly misidentifies people of color, especially women, children. So it misidentifies some groups more than others. So it's unreliable, and it's very vulnerable. There's already been hackings that have taken place. Border Patrol got hacked at one point, and it was just a huge database of traveler photos. So this is one of those scenarios where this software is poor. This software is very unregulated. I mean, Silicon Valley companies can pretty much sell this to private companies. They can do whatever they want with it. And it's very susceptible to hacking and breaching. So it's a huge overreach on our civil liberties. It's already been abused by law enforcement too. I mean, there's been documentation out there of it's very common for them to consult these databases without warrants, without probable cause. There's even been, for instances, where police officers have used these databases to try to find information on an ex. So
right.
It's one of those things.
That one I believe the absolute most. That is a certainty. Like, that's the same way that they put on their like sirens when they go through a red light. Like, I think that that happens probably most. But so, so who all is using this facial recognition, and how, and like, actually more specifically, like, how do we go about getting more accountability as to how they're using it?
ICE is using it. Law enforcement is in general is using it. And there's probably some more stuff going on in the private sphere that we're not even privy to. And that's part of the biggest problem. There's really no accountability going on right now. And that's why we're calling for a straight out ban. You know, there's some folks in Silicon Valley who have money to be made from this. They're saying, oh, well, we can have some regulation and that's going to be enough. And by the way, we'll help you write the regulation. Well, to me, this sounds like net neutrality all over again, where it's like, hey, let's have the cable companies write the net neutrality bill so that it's not really net neutrality at all. We're not going to fall for that one. We need to ban this stuff. It does not have any benefit for society. Even if it did what it's supposed to do, which it doesn't, I still think that the cost outweighs the benefit tenfold. So we got to ban it. And Fight for the Future has a website, banfacialrecognition.com. where folks can sign that petition to send a message to the lawmakers that we need to ban this. And three cities have already gotten on board with this: Oakland, California, San Francisco, California, and Somerville, Massachusetts, just outside of Boston. So the movement is picking up steam, and it's generating some momentum, and hopefully that continues. So banfacialrecognition.com is the place where folks ought to go.
Awesome. And then how do people watch your show and get involved with your viewer-curated news experience?
Yeah, Get Your News On with Ron. We stream every Monday through Thursday. Usually we do it at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Pacific, but that varies sometimes based on my road schedule and other things. And that's just youtube.com/Ron Placone, and all my tour dates can be found at ronplacone.com.
Awesome. Thank you for being with us, Ron, and good luck with the show.
Thanks for having me. And again, can I just plug that website one more time, banfacialrecognition.com. Please go sign that petition. Tell your lawmakers.
And everybody, get your news on with Ron. I think I left out an on there earlier. So thank you again. And we'll see you next time on the show.
Cheers, buddy. Good seeing you.
You too. All right, don't go away. When we come back, Brooke and I got in a pretty intense argument before the show started. And maybe we'll rehash it
on
the air.
No, I don't want to.
She doesn't want to. We'll be back.
Welcome back. This is a sad story. A New York father was actually in court. This is the appearance right behind me, facing charges, criminal charges, in the deaths of his twin children, a little boy, a little girl, both 1 year old. His name is Juan Rodriguez, and he was actually charged with two counts each of manslaughter and criminally negligent homicide. Police say he left the two babies alone in a parked car for hours in the summer heat. Well, he put in a day at work. They also say it appeared that he drove off after finishing work before realizing the victims were in the vehicle and started frantically summoning help. Prosecutors say Rodriguez told police he thought he had dropped the twins off at daycare. They say he told police, "I blanked out. My babies are dead. I killed my babies." This is a sad story. There's an average of 39 heat stroke deaths of children locked in cars nationwide per year, according to kidsincars.org. And that's a website that actually tracks the deaths. It says of July 16th, there had been 21 this year. Prosecutors say 39-year-old Rodriguez was working an 8-hour shift at a hospital while this happened. So we were talking about this morning and having this discussion about how often these accidents are charged as crimes. Should they be crimes? That's our opinion, really. It doesn't necessarily matter.
Yeah, it's one of those things that that it seems like it should be a crime. Like, it feels like if you are child endangerment, child negligence, up to a certain point is a crime, or definitely is a crime. So if you like accidentally throw, like, I guess it comes down to the line between what's an accident and what's negligence.
Right.
And that's really what you litigate in a court of law. And add to that how terrible a parent who genuinely made a mistake and wasn't acting like with any intent or has no history of negligence to their child, how much you hold them accountable.
Right.
But like, What do you think?
Yeah, for me, I think this is never a crime. And I do think that these things, when somebody dies, there needs to be an investigation, obviously. Yeah. But I think that this is a terrible accident that happens often, unfortunately. And I don't think after dealing with the accidental death of your children after a mistake you made, you should then be put in prison. I don't know if, so I took a look.
Right, but there's no way to know whether it was genuinely an accident until you've gone through the legal process. That's the
issue. Can you do that with an investigation before it's sent to court?
Right, yeah.
And before you're charged with a crime?
Yeah, and that's how it works.
Yeah, that works for me. So I took a look at, there's a piece in the Washington Post kind of broke down, like how often this happens, when they're charged with crimes, when they're not. And there were two cases in different parts of Virginia. And just the different words coming from the prosecutors, I thought was interesting in both instances. And obviously this is just two cases, but two cases in the same state of two different people accidentally leaving their children in hot cars and the children died. Miles Harrison forgot to drop his son off at daycare. He was charged with manslaughter. The Commonwealth's attorney in that case said, there's a lot to be said for reaffirming people's obligations to protect their children. When you have children, you have responsibilities. I am very strong in the defense of children's safety. And that was part of his reasoning for why this, no matter what, needed to be charged. This needed to be, you know, treated like a crime. In the other part of Virginia, Andrew Culpepper picked his toddler son up from his parents, drove home, and then went into the house and fell asleep. He was not charged with the crime. The prosecutor in that case said, as tragic as the child's death was, a police investigation showed there was no crime because there was no intent. Culpepper wasn't callously gambling with the child's life. He had just forgotten the child was there. And so it really, it's the same situation. It just comes up to the prosecutor's decision. It also
from my limited research, varies from state to state.
Right.
So, the variance from state to state in a weird circular way kind of proves that folks really, it's tough to articulate this.
Sure.
And that is the essence of laws. There's laws that are very clearly horrible and have a different intent than what is written into the law, such as like sentencing for marijuana possessions. That is easy to see the weird, nefarious sociological like architecture intent there. But with this, I mean, yes, one could say that your punishment, if it was just an accident, is you live the rest of your life knowing that you did a horrible thing, and that's it. It's going to ruin your marriage. It's going to ruin you're going to feel insane amounts of guilt. I mean, people who have kids who die in car crashes where the kid was kid's friend was driving. Mm-hmm. Those parents still feel an insane amount of guilt. How did I let them go? There was nothing I could have done. This, there is some level. I mean, it should be adjudicated in a court of law, in my opinion, to what extent you are negligent and if there was a pattern of negligence leading into this. And I think that if you can establish a pattern, then there should be more punishment. I know that there are certain states like Kentucky, it says it's a lot. You can leave your kid.
Mitch McConnell state. Also.
Mitch McConnell, but it's felony manslaughter if the child dies. There are these things that get kicked in. It's a discussion of all the way up to like mandatory minimums for things like this. When really there are certain legal shifts that people have tried to do in criminal reform, in criminal justice reform, that allow us to take a step back. Like there's there's three different ways that they suggest drug sentencing, the triumvirate, I forget what it's called, but there's three different sentences and they allow the judge to be like, okay, what is actually happening here? I know this is the letter of the law, but does it seem to me like this was actually an accident? I'm not going to punish them. I'm going to dismiss this case.
Yeah. It's hard. I think that also when we look at these laws, we have to also remember that we like to put people in prison in this country. The rates that people are put in prison in this country compared to every other country, it's absurd.
I think people like to have this conversation where it's like, oh, here is just this crazy, intense, like emotionally destructive thing, like a kid in a car dies.
Right.
And people like to have this conversation.
Absolutely.
But I mean, there's different laws in different states that require different burdens of proof and potential sentencings.
Yeah. I don't know. It doesn't sit right with me. It's a horrible accident. And I don't think this man should be in prison. I don't think he should have been spending a night in Rikers.
Looking at that, I don't think that guy should be in prison. Yeah. But I think if someone is torturing their child and then leaves them in a locked car, they should go to prison.
Well, we agree on that.
I want to thank you guys for watching the show. And watch throughout the week. Don't forget the debate coverage, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.